Chapter 12, Corruption as a Human Rights Violation. The United Nations was set up in the aftermath of World War II for the purpose of securing peace and stability in the world. The horror of war, the death and suffering that is engendered by war, and most of all, the indignity of violent conflict impelled the representatives of all nations to seek a better world. The thinking behind the establishment of the UN Charter in the course of 1945 is revealed in its preamble. To save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. One of the first projects of the UN was to draft and agree the terms of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The text was prepared by representatives with different legal and cultural backgrounds from all regions of the world. The declaration was proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on the 10th of December 1948. General Assembly Resolution 217A. As a common standard of achievements for all peoples and all nations. It sets out, for the first time, fundamental human rights to be universally protected, and it has been translated into over 500 languages. The preamble of the Declaration is a vivid reflection of the philosophy that motivated its adoption. It reads, "Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world, whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind, and the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief, and freedom from fear and want, has been proclaimed as the highest aspiration of the common people. Whereas it is essential, if man is not to be compelled to have recourse, as a last resort, to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. Whereas it is essential to promote the development of friendly relations between nations, whereas the peoples of the United Nations have in the Charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in equal rights for men and women, and have determined to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, whereas member states have pledged themselves to achieve, in cooperation with the United Nations, the promotion of universal respect for and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms. Whereas a common understanding of these rights and freedoms is of the greatest importance for the realization of this pledge. Now, therefore, the General Assembly proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations, to the end that every individual and every organ of society, keeping this declaration constantly in mind, shall strive by teaching and education to promote respect for those rights and freedoms, and by progressive measures, national and international, to secure their universal and effective recognition and observance both among the peoples of member states themselves and among the peoples of territories under their jurisdiction." It can be seen from these fine words that while tyranny and oppression are singled out as enemies of human rights, there is no express reference to corruption as a factor in the project of rolling out universal human rights so as to promote equality and dignity. This omission is significant. The closest the declaration comes to identifying corruption as a problem for or challenge to promoting human rights is the sentiment that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. As we have noted in an earlier chapter, the definition of the rule of law developed by the World Justice Project does make it clear that absence of corruption is a factor in measuring the health of the rule of law. Corruption is accordingly a factor which should be considered in relation to the protection of human rights, inherent human dignity, and equality are at the forefront of these rights. There are two articles in the Declaration that have bearing on this discussion of corruption as a human rights issue. The first is in the article dealing with property, Article 17, which reads, 1. Everyone has the right to own property alone, as well as in association with others. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his property. The second is part of Article 29, subsection 2. In the exercise of his rights and freedoms, everyone shall be subject only to such limitations as are determined by law, solely for the purpose of securing due recognition and respect for the rights and freedoms of others and of meeting the just requirements of morality, public order, and the general welfare in a democratic society. The protection of property rights also features in the World Justice Project definition of the rule of law, while meeting the just requirements of morality, can obviously not be achieved in any nation in which corruption is countenanced. State capture and grand corruption involve illegal interference in property rights, while all forms of corruption cannot possibly pass the test of the just requirements of morality. The guarantees of life, liberty, equality, and security contained in the Declaration implicitly protect people and nations against the abuse of power by the corrupt. The UN eventually processed a convention against corruption in the period 2001 to 2003. The opening words of its preamble reveal the concerns and the intent of the state parties to the convention. The preamble reads, "The state parties to this convention, concerned about the seriousness of problems and threats posed by corruption to the stability and security of societies, undermining the institutions and values of democracy, ethical values, and justice, and jeopardizing sustainable development and the rule of law. Concerned also about the links between corruption and other forms of crime, in particular organized crime and economic crime, including money laundering. Concerned further about cases of corruption that involve vast quantities of assets, which may constitute a substantial portion of the resources of states, and that threaten the political stability and sustainable development of those states. Convinced that corruption is no longer a local matter, but a transnational phenomenon that affects all societies and economies, making international cooperation to prevent and control it essential. Convinced also that a comprehensive and multidisciplinary approach is required to prevent and combat corruption effectively. The purposes of the Convention Against Corruption are spelt out in the opening words of Chapter 1, Article 1. The purposes of this convention are A. to promote and strengthen measures to prevent and combat corruption more efficiently and effectively. B. to promote, facilitate, and support international cooperation and technical assistance in the prevention of and fight against corruption, including in asset recovery. C. to promote integrity, accountability, and proper management of public affairs and public property.
Arguably, the most important undertakings in the United Nations Convention Against Corruption are those set out in Article 5, which deals with the prevention of corruption. All too often, these commitments are honored in the breach by the states' parties to the Convention.
Article 5. Preventive anti-corruption policies and practices. 1. Each state party shall, in accordance with the fundamental principles of its legal system, develop and implement or maintain effective coordinated anti-corruption policies that promote the participation of society and reflect the principles of the rule of law, proper management of public affairs and public property, integrity, transparency, and accountability. 2. Each state party shall endeavor to establish and promote effective practices aimed at the prevention of corruption. 3. Each state party shall endeavor to periodically evaluate relevant legal instruments and administrative measures with a view to determining their adequacy to prevent and fight corruption. In his foreword to the convention, then Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, remarked that the convention is the culmination of work that started many years ago, when the word corruption was hardly ever uttered in official circles. It took systematic efforts, first at the technical and then gradually at the political level, to put the fight against corruption on the global agenda. Both the Monterey International Conference on Financing for Development and the Johannesburg World Summit on Sustainable Development offered opportunities for governments to express their determination to attack corruption and to make many more people aware of the devastating effect that corruption has on development. The convention is also the result of long and difficult negotiations. Many complex issues and many concerns from different quarters had to be addressed. It was a formidable challenge to produce, in less than 2 years, an instrument that reflects all those concerns. All countries had to show flexibility and make concessions. But we can be proud of the result. Corruption, now broadly viewed as a human rights issue, has been discussed in detail by conference delegates who heard the presentations made by Professor Max du Plessis at the Cape Town Conference and Gareth Newham of the Institute of Security Studies at the Johannesburg Conference, which ended on the 24th of November 2016. Their contributions reflect the progress that has been made since the adoption of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption and its entry into force in December 2005. As at February 2020, there are 187 states parties to the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. After the United Nations Convention Against Corruption was adopted, the legislature in South Africa was not slow to take up the cudgels in relation to corrupt activities. It passed the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act in 2005. The Act has the nickname PRECA. It creates the gateway for the courts to regard corruption as a human rights violation. The words used in the first few lines of the preamble of the Act reveal the thinking of the legislature. Whereas the Constitution enshrines the rights of all people in the Republic and affirms the democratic values of human dignity, equality, and freedom, and whereas the Constitution places a duty on the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all the rights as enshrined in the Bill of Rights, and whereas corruption and related corrupt activities undermine the said rights, endanger the stability and security of societies,
undermine the institutions and values of democracy and ethical values and morality, jeopardize sustainable development, the rule of law, and the credibility of governments, and provide a breeding ground for organized crime. And whereas the illicit acquisition of personal wealth can be particularly damaging to democratic institutions, national economies, ethical values, and the rule of law. That preamble to PRECA sets out the reason for passing PRECA into law in South Africa. The Supreme Court of Appeal, in the 2005 appeal to it in the corruption prosecution of Jacob Zuma's former financial advisor, Shabir Sheikh, emphasized that corruption is a threat to the rule of law, good governance, democracy, and fundamental human rights. It put, in emphatic terms, the scope of these threats in the trenchant findings it made against Sheikh. He had subverted his friendship with Zuma into a relationship of patronage. His purpose was designed to achieve power and wealth. He had behaved aggressively and threateningly, using Zuma's name to intimidate people into submitting to his will. He had sought out people eager to exploit Zuma's powers and influence and had colluded with them to achieve mutually beneficial results. The court held that the seriousness of the offence of corruption could not be overemphasized. It offended against the rule of law and the principles of good governance. It lowered the moral tone of the nation, and it threatened the constitutional order. As to the merits of the appeal, the court held no fault could be found with the reasoning of the trial court that no substantial or compelling circumstances existed that would justify the imposition of a sentence other than the prescribed minimum of 15 years imprisonment. In the result, all the sentences imposed by the trial court stood. Shortly after he was imprisoned, Sheikh was able, by devious means, to negotiate medical parole on the basis that he was terminally ill. He is still alive many years later and is often seen playing golf in his hometown, Durban. The case against Zuma, based on the same factual matrix, has been delayed for years due to its withdrawal, reinstatement after protracted judicial review proceedings, which included appeals and a challenge to the reinstatement of the charges, but is likely to proceed during 2021 after the lockdown for the virus called COVID-19 ends. Undue political pressure was brought to bear on an acting appointee to withdraw the charges against Zuma. The official opposition challenged the withdrawal in court by way of review proceedings, which became bogged down inside issues over access to documents and tape recordings of telephone calls. The delays suited Zuma. His defense counsel let it be known that the strategy in the litigation was a Stalingrad strategy, fighting house by house and street by street. In the Glenister litigation, the human rights aspect of countering of corruption received careful attention from the South African Constitutional Court. The second Glenister case was the first opportunity that the court had to give detailed consideration to the interplay between corruption and human rights. It did not disappoint. Using the preamble of PRECA as an indication of legislative intent to couple corruption with the non-delivery of human rights guaranteed to all in the Bill of Rights, the court was decisive in its analysis. Inasmuch as Section 7(2) of the Constitution records that the state is obliged to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all of the rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, it is a short and logical step to the conclusion that a failure to deliver because of the looting involved in grand corruption is prejudicial to the obligations of the state under Section 7(2).
From the perspective of the ordinary citizen, the Bill of Rights is the jewel in the crown of the post-liberation constitutional order in South Africa because of its commitment to the creation of a new order in which inherent human dignity, equality, and freedom are to become the order of the day. The socio-economic rights set out in the Bill of Rights are expensive to deliver. Rights to health care, social security, housing and education, as well as access to food and water, involve the state, via the taxpayer, in a great deal of expenditure. If the state is functioning in a manner that turns a blind eye to funding required for the delivery of human rights being diverted into the pockets of the corrupt, then the connection between corruption and human rights is made plain. Corruption is allowed to fell at the knees all we hold dear in this scenario, as explained by the joint majority judgment of Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke and Justice Cameron. It was on the basis of the constitutional need to uphold human rights and the international obligation to maintain effective and efficient anti-corruption machinery of state that the court found the initial incarnation of the Hawks, a mere police unit, was inadequately independent to acquit itself of the task at hand. Parliament was directed to come to the decision of a reasonable decision maker in the circumstances in revisiting the legislation that was successfully impugned by Glenister. In the process of so doing, Glenister was able to exploit the intricacies of the relationship between corruption and human rights, as well as the fulfilling of international obligations under the terms of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. As there are many countries in Africa and around the world which have a justiciable Bill of Rights, the obligation of these states to guard against corruption is fair game for adjudication in public interest litigation that may be required. The litigation will be needed if only lip service to the rule of law is in evidence in any particular country in which a public interest litigant follows in the footsteps of Glenister. Those countries which have domesticated their international obligations have the additional duties set out in Article 5 of the UN Convention Against Corruption. It is open to a public interest litigant to challenge any lack of compliance with the said article. The expense involved necessitates pro bono counsel, contingency fee arrangements, and public fundraising, if not a combination of all three strategies. Human rights activists have elevated respect for human rights to the point where it is possible to litigate when corruption can be seen to stymie the delivery of human rights. It is the task of anti-corruption activists to tackle the levels of corruption that will make the realization of the UN SDGs difficult to achieve, whether by 2030 or later. Rights to health care, housing, independent candidates being allowed to stand for election, and the right to adequate anti-corruption machinery of state have all been successfully litigated in South Africa. The chaos and disruption wrought by the COVID-19 pandemic has brought into sharp focus the need to have a world in which corrupt activities are not countenanced. Those involved in corrupt pandemic-related procurement have been likened to hyenas and murderers. It is to be hoped that the necessary focus and political will can be generated by the hardships of living through the pandemic to create a new world order which is not prepared to accommodate or allow corrupt activities to the extent that they've been tolerated in the past. That would be a new normal to look forward to and to be embraced by all who value the rule of law.